Imagine a scenario for a second. You're sitting at home, maybe reading, maybe watching something, and a severe weather anomaly rolls in.
Yeah, we're talking about a massive generational storm here.
Exactly. The winds tear through your region, snapping trees, and within minutes, knocking out the high voltage power lines.
It's that immediate cascading effect.
Right. And moments later, the high capacity internet fiber cables, which, run along those exact same utility corridors, are severed.
Completely cut off.
Yeah. Usually, this is the part of the story where the dread sets in, because this typically means days, maybe weeks, of total darkness.
Oh, absolutely.
It means cascading failures across your local grid. Millions of dollars lost in regional productivity, spoiled food, dangerous drops in temperature, and like a total blackout of communications. You are completely isolated.
It's a terrifying reality for a lot of people.
But what if, in the middle of all that atmospheric chaos, your local water treatment plant didn't go down?
Right. What if it just kept running?
Exactly. What if the regional hospital kept its lights on and the communication towers in your area just, kept broadcasting?
That changes the whole
What
equation.
if they just quietly, seamlessly disconnected from the dying macro grid and formed their own self-sustaining AI-managed bubble of power and data?
I mean, it sounds like the ultimate resilience fantasy, right? The
Totally.
idea that critical infrastructure could just shrug off a catastrophic regional collapse and say, we're fine, we'll handle this locally.
Yeah.
But diving into the stack of blueprints, the engineering white papers, and the gap analyses we have in front of us today, the most shocking realization is that this isn't a fantasy anymore.
No, not at all.
It is an active engineering reality.
And that is the mission of our deep dive today. We are exploring a radical physical shift in how we build the foundations of society.
It really is a complete paradigm shift.
We are moving away from massive, fragile, centralized grids toward a framework called sovereign autonomous infrastructure.
Also known in these papers as spherical resilience.
Yes, spherical resilience. And I want to set the baseline right off the bat for you listening. We are not talking about speculative science fiction here.
Definitely not.
We aren't talking about hyperscale billion-dollar data centers built deep inside mountains or anything.
Far from it, actually. I mean, the defining characteristic of the deployments detailed in these sources is their accessibility.
Right.
By utilizing commodity hardware-like off-the-shelf components you could theoretically source today, combined with open-source software and localized edge AI.
These systems are real.
Yeah, these spherically resilient systems are already being deployed.
And what's wild is where they're going. They are targeting the places historically left behind by big infrastructure.
Exactly. Rural areas, agricultural zones, disaster-prone coastal regions, developing economies.
So, to truly grasp how we build this autonomous, resilient future, we first need to dissect the architecture of the past.
Right. We have to look at why things are breaking.
Yeah, why our current systems, the ones keeping the lights on in your room right now, are failing so spectacularly when they're put under pressure.
The sources actually call our current design paradigm linear concentration.
Linear concentration. So explain that.
Well, if we look back at the last century of civil engineering and, regional planning, the entire philosophy has been obsessed with centralized scale.
Bigger is better.
Exactly. The logic dictated that bigger was always better. So we built massive centralized production nodes.
Like giant coal plants.
Right. Giant coal plants, sprawling nuclear facilities, or massive server farms. And then we connected those giant hubs to distributed consumers using long-haul, high-capacity corridors.
High voltage transmission lines, long haul fiber optics.
Single-source municipal water mains running for hundreds of miles. Yeah.
And I mean, I get the economic logic there. The white papers acknowledge that under perfectly stable, predictable conditions, this linear model is incredibly
Oh,
efficient.
yeah. You get massive economies of scale.
But the glaring downside is what the researchers term linear fragility.
Right.
I like to think of this legacy architecture like a long string of cheap holiday lights.
That's a great analogy.
If one bulb burns out, or if a branch falls and severs the wire in just one spot, the entire string downstream goes completely dark.
Yeah, it breaks the chain.
In our modern infrastructure, one physical disruption, say a transmission power twisting in a hurricane, or a digital severance, like a localized cyber attack on a transit router, it breaks the chain.
And it doesn't just isolate the damaged area.
No, it causes a massive systemic cascade. We saw this in the 2021 Texas power crisis, right?
Yeah, absolutely did.
One freeze at the natural gas wellheads propagated down the pipe, tripping offline the power plants, which then cut power to the very pumps needed to move the gas.
A perfect linear cascade. It's a textbook manifestation of linear fragility.
Yeah.
And the source documents actually model this phenomenon mathematically using graph theory, which provides a really fascinating lens.
Okay, let's get into the graph theory because this is where it gets crazy.
So if we model the modern utility network as a mathematical graph, the nodes are the physical substations or data centers.
Got it.
And the edges are the transmission lines or fiber optic links connecting them.
Okay, nodes and edges.
Right. Now, a traditional linear or tree topology has an edge connectivity equal to one.
Meaning there's only one physical path for the power or data to travel between any two points in the network.
Exactly. The shortest path, and often the only path, relies on a single, non-redundant route.
Which sounds incredibly risky.
It is. Statistically, if any critical link experiences an outage, the graph is mathematically partitioned into disconnected subgraphs.
A blackout.
Right. The white paper provides the exact formula for this systemic vulnerability. It says the probability of a systemic partition event is 1 minus, in parentheses, 1 minus P to the power of N.
Wait, let's break that down.
Sure. So P is the failure rate of a single link, and N is the number of links in the system.
Okay, let's walk through that math so we can really see the danger here. Let's say a single mile of transmission line has a tiny failure probability, just like a 1% chance of going down in a storm.
Sounds pretty safe, right?
Right. But if you have a linear grid spanning 100 miles, meaning 100 links, the probability of the network failing isn't 1%.
No.
It's 1 minus 0.99 to the power of 100, which comes out to a 63% chance of systemic failure.
Yeah, the math scales brutally.
And if you have 500 miles of line, that probability approaches 99 point something percent.
The math is just unforgiving. As the network grows geographically, as we add more miles of wire and fiber to serve expanding suburbs and rural frontier,
the risk just skyrockets.
Exactly. The probability of the network partitioning statistically approaches 100%.
Wow.
The sheer scale of long-haul linear transmission renders them mathematically destined to fail under stress. It is a statistical certainty.
And this is where the concept of spherical resilience completely upends the paradigm.
It really does.
Because the solution proposed to counter this, like mathematical doom loop, is transitioning the physical infrastructure to a K-connected mesh graph.
Right. And the engineering requirement specifies that K must be greater than or equal to 3.
Okay. Unpack that for us. What is a K-connected graph?
In graph theory, a K-connected graph is a network where you would have to remove K separate nodes or links to disconnect the network into isolated pieces.
So you need multiple simultaneous breaks.
Exactly. So in a K-connected mesh where K equals 3, every single node in the network, every local hospital, every municipal water pump, every emergency shelter maintains multiple redundant multi-directional pathways.
It has at least 3 distinct connections to other nodes.
Yeah, at minimum.
So instead of that single string of holiday lights, we're building something closer to chainmail.
Chainmail is a perfect way to visualize it.
The power of the data can flow up, down, left, right, or diagonally to reach its destination. If a tree falls and severs the link between the hospital and the fire station, the data doesn't just stop. It routes around the damage, maybe passing through the local high school's node to get to the fire station.
And that structural shift causes the underlying math to completely flip.
How so?
Well, in a spherically resilient model, isolating any single node requires the simultaneous failure of at least 3 independent paths.
Right. All 3 have to go down at once.
Exactly. So the probability of a node becoming completely disconnected drops drastically. It becomes the product of the failure probabilities of each independent path.
Okay, so going back to our example of a 1% failure rate.
Right. To isolate a node with 3 connections, all 3 must fail at the exact same time.
So the probability becomes 0.01 times 0.01 times 0.01.
Which is...
You're looking at a 1 in a million chance of isolation.
Exactly. Compared to a near certainty in the linear model.
That's a massive difference.
You're reducing systemic risk exponentially with every redundant connection you add.
Okay, I follow the math, and the topological theory sounds great on paper. But I have to push back here, based on the physical realities outlined in the gap analysis.
Sure. What's the concern?
In a normal linear macro grid, If a massive substation fails, its electrical load doesn't just vanish into the ether, right?
No, it has to go somewhere.
It gets dumped onto the next adjacent substation. And if that substation can't handle the sudden massive spike in demand, it trips its breakers to protect itself.
Which dumps an even larger load onto the next one.
Exactly. That is the physical mechanism of a cascading blackout. So even in a tightly connected chainmail-like mesh, wouldn't a massive power surge or a catastrophic node failure just instantly fry the adjacent nodes in a ripple effect?
It's a really valid point.
I mean, you haven't solved the cascade. You've just given it more paths to travel.
You are hitting on the core vulnerability of basic interconnected grids here. Oh. Physical mesh topology alone is actually dangerous without the second crucial component.
Which is?
The sources define this missing link as the autonomy factor, which they represent by the Greek letter theta.
The autonomy factor.
Right. In legacy networks, the autonomy factor is basically zero. Those traditional substations are entirely dependent.
They need the mothership.
Yes. They cannot function without the macro grid's real-time inputs. They constantly rely on synchronization clock signals or high-voltage reference lines from a centralized power plant to know what frequency to output and how to balance their load.
So when the macro grid drops or a massive surge hits, the legacy node goes totally blind.
Exactly. It has no local brain to figure out what to do, so it just shuts down to avoid catching fire.
But in a spherically resilient derticular architecture?
The autonomy factor approaches one. The physical nodes are designed with localized intelligence to physically bound the failure.
Bound the failure.
Right. When the upstream connectivity, whether that's electrical voltage stability or, you know, data packet consistency, drops below an acceptable quality of service threshold, the local node doesn't wait for instructions from a centralized cloud.
It acts on its own.
It activates an internal control loop and physically isolates itself from the chaos.
So it basically cuts the infected tissue to save the limb. It senses the surge coming from the damaged grid and slams the door shut, bounding the failure outside of its local bubble.
Yes. It protects the local region, keeping the critical infrastructure inside that bubble completely safe and operational.
Which opens up a massive logistical question for me.
Okay.
We've established the structural layout, the graph theory, the chainmail mesh, the concept of isolation. But what actually happens inside one of these nodes the second the macro grid collapses and it slams that door shut?
That's where things get really interesting.
Right. How does a local water plant or a rural hospital survive on its own without the massive power plant feeding it?
This is the mechanism of operational continuity, specifically what the engineers call island mode.
Island mode. I love that term.
It fits perfectly. When that upstream connection fails, the transition into island mode is not manual. You don't have, like, a facility manager running out to the yard in the rain to pull a giant mechanical lever.
Good, because that sounds terrible.
The nodes utilize fast-acting, solid-state automatic transfer switches, or SSHs.
Wait, how do those differ from the massive mechanical relays we usually see in legacy substations?
Well, mechanical relays rely on physical metal contacts slamming together or pulling apart.
Which takes time.
Right. They're slow, they're prone to wear, and they can actually arc under high loads. Solid-state switches, on the other hand, use semiconductor materials, like silicon carbide, to control the flow of electricity without any moving parts.
Wow. No moving parts.
None. They can detect a voltage anomaly and isolate the local electrical and data systems within milliseconds.
Milliseconds? So if the macro grid goes down, the lights in the hospital operating room might not even flicker.
The transition to local battery power is practically invisible to the equipment.
That continuous power quality is the main objective, right?
Exactly. But hardware alone isn't enough. You need an orchestration layer to manage it all.
The brain.
Right. The brain managing this survival mechanism is an edge-native microkernel operating system called RIOS, the Rural Infrastructure Operating System.
RIOS.
Yeah. And what makes RIOS fundamentally different from the software running our current smart grids is its architecture. It is strictly designed to operate reliably under fully air-gapped conditions.
Meaning it assumes the global internet is completely dead.
Precisely. Most smart grid tech today is essentially a thin client. It collects data, sends it to an Amazon or Google cloud server hundreds of miles away.
The cloud crunches the numbers.
And sends an instruction back. But if the fiber is cut, the smart grid becomes instantly dumb.
Because it can't reach the cloud.
Right. RIOS entirely eliminates that cloud dependency. It uses a microkernel design, meaning only the absolute minimum amount of code runs in the most privileged state of the processor.
Which I imagine makes it incredibly secure against cyber threats.
Highly secure. But more importantly, it makes it exceptionally stable for localized decision-making.
You know, I found the description of the RioSignal fusion engine in the sources absolutely fascinating.
It's a beast of a system.
I picture it like an incredibly stressed, highly caffeinated air traffic controller who never, ever sleeps.
That's a pretty accurate visual.
Its entire job is to constantly, like, millisecond by millisecond monitor all the physical communication interfaces pointing out of the node, right?
Yes. It is constantly evaluating the signal-to-noise ratio, looking for packet loss, and measuring latency jitter across multiple distinct communication layers.
It's dynamically managing disparate physical networks simultaneously.
Exactly. A typical resilience node will have a low Earth orbit, or AO, satellite backhaul like Starlink, along with local private LTE transceivers acting like a mini cellular tower.
And long-range 900 megahertz RF mesh interfaces.
Right. So if a hurricane wipes out the regional fiber optic lines, the RioSignal fusion engine instantly detects that drop in data traffic.
And it doesn't just, you know, throw an error code. It actively reroutes. So if the primary fiber is dead, it shards the critical data and pushes it over the satellite link.
Seamlessly.
But what if the storm is so intense or the satellite dish gets covered in heavy, wet snow and that link degrades?
Well, the signal fusion engine is constantly calculating link costs. As the satellite signal-to-noise ratio drops, it instantly reprioritizes.
It shifts gears again.
Yeah. It takes the absolutely critical data, say, emergency 911 dispatch communications, and pushes it through the much slower but highly reliable 900 megahertz RF mesh to the next available node down the valley.
And what happens to the rest of the data?
It drops non-essential data, like streaming video traffic, to ensure the dispatch signals get through. It guarantees communication survival by any medium necessary.
Okay, so the signal fusion engine handles the flow of information, but managing data is very different from managing physical industrial power.
Oh, absolutely.
How does the node control the heavy machinery when it's completely isolated?
That responsibility falls to the Autonomous Machine Coordination, or AMC engine.
The AMC.
Right. This is where Edge AI comes into play.
Right.
The AMC uses localized artificial intelligence to balance industrial loads, generate power, and manage battery discharge without any human intervention or cloud-based computation.
Wait, Edge AI. Let's pause there.
Sure.
When we hear about AI making complex dynamic decisions, we are usually talking about massive server farms filled with thousands of specialized processors consuming the power of a small city.
Right, the massive data centers.
Yeah. So how are they running load balancing AI on what essentially amounts to a metal box sitting in a field? The physics of compute power don't really seem to add up here.
Ah, so it is a vital distinction between training an AI model and running an AI model, which is called inferencing.
Okay, training versus inferencing.
Exactly. You need massive data centers to train the AI on years of historical grid data. But once the model understands the patterns, once it knows how a water pump's power draws spikes on startup, or how solar generation drops when a specific type of cloud cover rolls in, that compiled, highly efficient model is pushed down to the local node.
Ah, I see. So the local node isn't learning from scratch. It's executing a pre-trained playbook.
Exactly. And executing that model requires remarkably little compute power.
Really?
Yeah, the sources mentioned that they are running these inferencing models on localized commodity hardware. We're talking industrial mini PCs, consumer-grade GPUs, or efficient ARM-based systems physically located inside the node's server rack.
So just localized reasoning.
Just localized reasoning, yeah.
And this localized reasoning is making literal life or death decisions during a disaster. The AMC engine is constantly balancing local power generation from its solar panels against the critical municipal loads.
Yeah.
Let's look at a concrete scenario from the text. Say the node is managing a town's utility hub. A hurricane has knocked out the macro grid, and heavy cloud cover means the node's solar panels aren't generating much power.
A classic worst-case scenario.
All right. The battery levels are steadily dropping. What does the AMC do?
It implements a triage protocol based on those pre-trained models. If the battery capacity drops below a critical threshold, the AMC engine might analyze the community's immediate needs.
It looks at the big picture.
Yeah, it knows that maintaining hydrostatic pressure for the municipal water pumps is paramount, not just for drinking water, but because the fire department needs pressure in the hydrants to fight post-storm fires.
So it autonomously decides to shed non-essential loads.
Exactly.
It might cut power to the administrative offices or dim the streetlights, routing every available watt to keep the water pump spinning.
And it does this instantly without waiting for a town council meeting or a utility executive to sign off.
It is sovereign survival.
That's the perfect term for it.
I mean, whether you are in a politically fragmented region facing international sanctions that block cloud access, or you are managing a rural agricultural cooperative miles from the nearest fiber line.
Or standing in the rubble of a coastal city after a Category 5 hurricane.
Exactly. These nodes keep the foundational layers of your community alive. Because the physical container houses an IP67-rated compute cluster running cryptographically verified local databases, the region's telephony, emergency dispatch, and local commerce ledgers can function completely offline.
The local state engine ensures that administrative actions and access control lists remain active, even if the rest of the world goes totally dark.
Okay, so we have this autonomous, AI-driven, multi-network survival node that triages power and data like a battlefield medic.
It's incredibly robust.
It sounds it. But reading through the SWOT analysis, the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats breakdown in the engineering documents, there is a massive glowing vulnerability right in the middle of all this high-tech optimism.
Oh, the maintenance gap.
Yes. Advanced edge compute servers, solid-state switches, lithium battery arrays, and RF mesh networks require highly specialized, expensive upkeep.
They absolutely do.
Rural and under-resourced municipalities do not have teams of advanced systems engineers or cybersecurity professionals on payroll.
No, they usually just have a small public works team.
Right. So if a highly specialized power inverter blows a capacitor in a town of 500 people, who fixes it? The local diesel mechanic. You can't just hand them a wrench and tell them to reverse engineer a solid-state microgrid.
The white papers identify this precisely as the rural technical skill deficit, and it is frankly the graveyard of countless well-intentioned infrastructure projects.
I bet.
Deploying advanced technology into environments lacking advanced maintenance capabilities usually guarantees a rapid failure rate. The system has to bridge that maintenance gap structurally.
Which is where the RIO's automated diagnostics come into play.
Right.
The system basically has to monitor its own decay.
Precisely. The diagnostic engine is constantly analyzing the microfluctuations in the hardware. If it detects a degrading cell string within the battery bank or an increasing thermal variance across an inverter phase,
it doesn't wait for it to break.
Exactly. It doesn't wait for the component to catch fire and crash the node. It predicts the failure curve.
And because of the multipath routing we discussed earlier, it securely transmits that encrypted diagnostic alert over a ILIO satellite or an RF link to a regional dispatch center well before the catastrophic failure actually occurs.
It literally raises its hand and says, "My left battery array will fail in approximately 14 days.
But the truly brilliant engineering isn't just predicting the failure. It's how they designed the physical hardware to be repaired.
Yes, the modularity.
They moved away from complex integrated circuitry that requires on-site troubleshooting with oscilloscopes and soldering irons.
Which a local mechanic couldn't do.
Right. The documentation outlines a physical design philosophy that immediately made me think of old school video game cartridges.
Or printer ink, yeah.
Exactly. Everything is modular. The node is built entirely with sealed, field-replaceable units, or FRUs.
Modularity is the only way to achieve economic and operational viability in remote regions. When the regional technician receives that diagnostic alert, they don't need a master's degree in electrical engineering to solve the problem.
They just swap the part.
Yeah. They pull the specific replacement module from regional inventory, drive out to the site, unlatch the failing drawer, slide it out, and slide the new one in.
It clicks into place, auto-configures via the RIO software, and the node is back to full capacity.
Simple as that.
We should probably paint a picture for everyone listening of what this infrastructure in a box actually looks like.
Good idea.
If I'm a town planner, what exactly is getting dropped onto my concrete pad? The blueprints outline a standard phase zero deployment.
So the physical envelope holding all of this is an intermodal 20-foot ISO high cube shipping container.
Standardizing on the shipping container format is incredibly pragmatic.
It really is.
You instantly bypass prolonged civil engineering design cycles for custom buildings. A container can be moved via rail, loaded onto a cargo vessel, or dragged on a flatbed truck to practically anywhere on the planet using existing logistics networks.
It is ruggedized, weatherproof, and ubiquitous. Now, regarding power generation, the primary source is a 150-kilowatt bifacial monocrystalline solar array.
Wait, hold on. 150 kilowatt solar array requires a massive amount of surface area.
It does.
I've seen utility scale solar farms. How in the world are they fitting that much generation capacity inside a 20-foot box? The physics of volume just don't allow for that.
Well, they utilize a highly engineered mechanical scissor jack mounting system.
Like an accordion.
Kind of. The panels are stacked and compressed tightly inside the container during transit. Once the container is placed on site, the roof opens and hydraulic actuators unfold the array outwards and upwards, expanding the surface area significantly beyond the footprint of the container itself.
That is amazing.
And because they are bifacial panels, they capture direct sunlight from above, as well as light reflecting off the ground below, maximizing efficiency in a compressed space.
Okay, so that expanded array feeds the energy storage system. The specs say it's a 400 kilowatt hour liquid-cooled battery energy storage system.
Also known as a BS.
Right. But I noticed they specifically highlight the chemistry, lithium iron phosphate, or LiFePO4.
Yes.
Why that specific chemistry? Most consumer electronics and electric vehicles use nickel manganese cobalt, or NMC, because it holds more energy in a smaller space.
It comes down to prioritizing rugged survival over pure energy density. NMC batteries hold more juice, but they are highly susceptible to thermal runaway.
Meaning they catch fire easily.
Right. If they get punctured or overheat, they catch fire, and those fires are nearly impossible to put out.
Mm.
In a remote, unmonitored infrastructure node, a battery fire is a total loss event. Lithium iron phosphate chemistry, however, is incredibly thermally stable. It is practically fireproof under stress.
And the operational lifespan is vastly superior, right?
Oh, vastly. An NMC battery might degrade significantly after 1,000 charge cycles. The LiFePO4 arrays used in these nodes boast a massive operational lifespan of over 6,000 deep charge cycles.
Wow, 6,000?
Yeah. When you're deploying infrastructure meant to last decades without major overhauls, you sacrifice a little bit of space for a massive gain in longevity and safety. The battery compartment even features an automated aerosol-based fire suppression system as a final failsafe.
And what about the servers running the Rios microkernel and the Edge AI?
They're housed in a separate IP67-rated server rack.
IP67, so.
Meaning it is entirely dust-tight and can survive temporary submersion in water. The rack holds 3 high-availability edge compute servers. These servers are equipped with dedicated hardware security modules, which physically store the cryptographic keys needed for that localized trust and secure P2P trading we will discuss later.
Putting sensitive servers inside a metal box sitting in a sunny field sounds like a recipe for a thermal meltdown.
Which is why the rack is kept stable by dual redundant closed loop HVAC systems. They don't pull outside air in, which would introduce dust and humidity.
Right.
They circulate and cool the internal air, rated to keep the processors functioning in external ambient temperatures, ranging from negative 30 degrees Celsius up to a blistering 55 degrees Celsius.
Okay, the hardware sounds practically indestructible, but looking at the SWOT analysis again, there is a glaring environmental threat explicitly called out.
Extended low insulation events.
Exactly. What if there is a massive blizzard that covers the folding array in snow for 2 weeks? Or what if a region experiences weeks of heavy, dense cloud cover?
The solar panels won't generate much.
Right. 150 kilowatt solar array and a 400 kilowatt hour battery are impressive, but they won't cut it if the sun doesn't shine for 14 days. The math catches up to you. Does the whole node just die?
If the node relied purely on solar and batteries, yes, it would eventually hit a critical low voltage state and shut down to protect the cells. It would be highly vulnerable to seasonal weather anomalies.
So what's the backup?
This is exactly why the engineering specifications mandate the integration of a tertiary power source, a 30 kilowatt variable speed, hydrogen-ready auxiliary thermal generator.
A combustion generator. So there is an engine block inside the box. But hydrogen.
It is a combustion backup, yes, but designed for a zero carbon future. While it can run on natural gas or propane if necessary, it is engineered to burn hydrogen gas.
Okay.
It serves purely as baseload support. During those extended multi-week low solar events, the AMC engine detects the prolonged battery drain and automatically fires up the thermal generator. It runs at a highly efficient constant speed to trickle charge the battery bank and maintain critical loads.
So it's a hybrid orchestration. The AI balances the solar, the batteries, and the generator.
Precisely. This tri-party system ensures continuous operation without relying on constant fuel deliveries, which are impossible during a disaster anyway.
Right.
In fact, this robust combination limits routine preventative maintenance for the entire node to just twice a year.
Twice a year. You deploy a critical infrastructure hub, and you only send someone to check on it every 6 months.
The biannual schedule basically involves a technician cleaning the solar panels to maximize efficiency, verifying the aerosol fire suppression canisters haven't lost pressure, and running a physical state of charge capacity test on the batteries.
That's it.
That's it. The node essentially monitors and manages itself for the other 363 days of the year.
So we have advanced ruggedized hardware. We have autonomous AI routing data over satellites and balancing power. We have modular swappable components.
Sounds perfect, right?
Well, reading through every single piece of municipal planning documentation in our stack, one overarching theme screams off the page: cost.
Ah, yes. The economics.
The SWOT analysis bluntly lists higher localized unit cost as a primary weakness. If you decentralize infrastructure, you lose massive economies of scale. It is mathematically cheaper per megawatt to build one giant billion-dollar natural gas plant for 10 million people than it is to build 10,000 high-tech microgrids.
How does a local rural community of 5,000 people afford this highly advanced hardware without taking on massive crippling debt?
You are hitting on the fundamental friction point of modern infrastructure, the capital expenditure, or CapEx, barrier.
CapEx, right.
To understand the solution, we have to look at the history. Historically, public infrastructure meant centralized CapEx. If a state wanted to build a power plant or lay massive fiber lines, it was almost always funded by municipal bonds and multi-decade sovereign debt.
The town borrows $50 million, builds a substation, and the taxpayers spend the next 30 years paying off the interest.
Exactly. And because of this centralized debt model, utility planners are entirely beholden to return on investment.
Right. They look at a map and they see a dense urban center where a new transmission line will serve a million paying customers. Then they look at a semi-rural town or a marginalized agricultural community where the same expensive transmission line will only serve 2,000 people.
The ROI is terrible.
Terrible. So those communities are systematically ignored. They're left with aging, fragile infrastructure because they don't justify the centralized debt.
So if centralized debt redlines these communities, how do they get the node?
The sources introduce a completely novel economic framework designed to circumvent municipal debt entirely. Decentralized physical infrastructure networks, or DPIN.
DPIN.
Yes. DPIN shifts the entire economic model from centralized top-down debt to community-funded fractionalized ownership.
Honestly, DPIN sounds like a crypto bro buzzword, but the mechanics detailed in these white papers are deeply pragmatic. How does a town actually use a DPIN framework to physically get a container dropped on their lot?
It operates on what the industry calls a microgrid as a service, or MAAS model.
Okay, microgrid as a service.
Instead of the town council issuing a massive bond to borrow $2 million to buy the hardware, external capital steps in. Public-private partnerships, local agricultural cooperatives, or even distributed institutional investors purchase the initial phase zero hardware.
They buy the box?
Yes. They physically deploy it in the town. The municipality doesn't pay a massive upfront cost. They simply sign a contract to pay a fixed, predictable utility fee for the energy and data the node provides.
Wait, so the town gets instant spherical resilience, zero upfront capital layout, and according to the financial projections here, this fixed fee is often lower than their historical, highly volatile utility bills from the legacy monopoly.
It is, yeah.
What is the catch? Why would external investors do this?
Because of the crucial economic pivot enabled by DPIN, retaining local revenue in peer-to-peer, or P2P, trading. We have to look at how wealth moves in the legacy system.
I think of the traditional centralized utility model like a community garden, but a highly extractive one.
Explain that.
Imagine a town grows a massive garden. Every month, they harvest their tomatoes, which represents their energy payments and incredibly valuable data about their consumption habits.
Right.
And they load them onto a truck. That truck drives hundreds of miles away to a massive, distant supermarket chain owned by multinational utility conglomerates.
Taking all the value with it.
Exactly. The town gets a tiny fraction of the value back in the form of electricity, but the vast majority of the wealth they generated leaves the community forever. It builds high-rises in distant state capitals.
That is a perfect visualization of the economic drain rural communities face. But with a spherically resilient Duratier mesh network utilizing DPIN, you put a fence around the community garden.
Oh, I like that.
Any surplus energy generated by the node's solar array, say the batteries are full but the sun is still shining, and any surplus data routing capacity can be traded peer-to-peer within the regional mesh.
So if the local hospital's node has full batteries, but the municipal water pump's node across town is running low because of heavy daytime usage?
The hospital node autonomously sells its extra power directly to the water pump.
Wow. And that transaction happens instantly, verified by the local cryptographic hardware modules we mentioned earlier.
Yes. The economic value of that transaction circulates locally. The tomatoes are traded with the neighbor whose plot is in the shade today. The currency never leaves the fence.
So the investors who bought the hardware get a cut of these microtransactions, providing their ROI.
Exactly.
But does the town just rent this equipment forever?
No, and that is the true power of the fractionalized ledger. Over time, the Depend framework allows the local municipality or even individual citizens participating in the local cooperative to use the value generated by the mesh to systematically purchase fractional shares of the hardware node.
So they buy it back over time.
Every time the node sells surplus power, a portion of that revenue buys out the original investors. Eventually, the community outright owns the physical asset that is powering them. They transition from perpetual renters of fragile energy to sovereign owners of resilient infrastructure.
The localized economics are brilliant, the hardware is rugged, the AI is autonomous. It seems like an airtight solution. But there is a massive, real-world, highly political hurdle detailed extensively in the gap analysis.
The utilities.
Yes. How does a local regional planner actually execute this deployment without getting bogged down in years of crushing litigation with the massive utility monopolies that currently control the grid? They aren't just going to sit back and watch towns build independent community gardens.
They absolutely will not. And this is perhaps the most pragmatic, hard-hitting section of the white paper, overcoming the regulatory bottleneck.
All right.
Modern public utility commissions, or PUCs, operate on archaic, century-old regulatory codes.
Right.
In most jurisdictions, these codes dictate a very specific legal definition. They state that any system distributing electricity across public rights-of-way, meaning crossing a street to serve multiple independent buildings, must be legally classified as an electrical corporation.
Meaning, if a town tries to build a multi-customer microgrid linking the hospital, the fire station, and the school, they suddenly get legally classified the exact same way as a giant nuclear energy provider like PG&E or Kinetison.
Exactly. And once you are classified as an electrical corporation, you are subjected to the full weight of utility regulation. You get thrown into multi-year interconnection steady queues where the legacy utility takes years to decide if you are allowed to connect to their wires.
You face heavy PUC oversight, massive legal fees, and administrative overhead.
Paralyzing.
It seems clear that these laws, while originally designed for safety, are now weaponized as regulatory capture to protect the legacy monopolies from localized competition.
That's the effect, yes.
If the legacy monopoly can just use lawyers to block you from connecting to the grid, isn't this entire concept of spherical resilience dead on arrival?
It would be entirely dead on arrival if the deployment strategy required immediate integration with the macro grid. But the sources outline a highly specific, legally bulletproof, three-phase deployment playbook for municipal leaders to bypass this bottleneck entirely.
A legal bypass. I love a good bureaucratic loophole.
It's very smart.
Let's walk through this timeline. Phase one is listed as months 1 through 3. What is the town planner doing during this initial period?
Phase one is purely about defining the resilience hubs. The municipal planner maps out the critical facilities in their region that absolutely cannot fail during a disaster.
Like the water pumps and the emergency shelters.
Right, and the administrative dispatch centers. They identify where the legacy utility meters currently attach to these buildings. Then they secure standard local zoning permits to pour a concrete pad and place an ISO shipping container on the property.
So phase one is just local administrative work. You aren't asking the state PUC for anything. You are just pouring concrete on town property. Then we hit phase two, which covers months 4 through 6. This is where the clever maneuver happens. The blueprints call it the behind-the-meter strategy.
The behind-the-meter, or BTM, phase zero deployment is the key to the whole operation. Instead of asking the legacy utility for permission to build a multi-building microgrid that crosses public streets, the planner drops the infrastructure in a box directly on the property of the single critical facility.
So just on the hospital's land?
Yes. They place the container right next to the hospital, and they wire it physically behind the hospital's existing utility meter.
Meaning the node is sitting between the hospital's circuit breaker and the main grid connection.
Precisely.
So from the legacy utility company's perspective, what does this look like?
It just looks like the hospital is suddenly using a lot less power from the main grid because the node's solar panels and batteries are handling the load locally. It offsets the facility's consumption, saving the town money immediately. But crucially, it provides immediate autonomous island mode resilience for that specific building without exporting a single watt of power back out to the macro grid.
But the utility companies will argue safety. They will say, if the grid goes down, your rogue battery box is going to backfeed power onto the deadlines and electrocute the linemen trying to fix the poles.
They absolutely will argue that.
How do you legally counter that?
By strictly adhering to established engineering standards. The dereticular nodes are certified to comply with UL 1741, which is the standard for inverters, and IEEE 1547, which governs the interconnection of distributed resources.
Okay, what do those standards actually do?
These standards require built-in anti-islanding mechanisms. The solid-state switches we discussed earlier constantly monitor the frequency and voltage of the macro grid. The microsecond they detect the grid has failed, the switch physically breaks the connection.
So it is mechanically and digitally impossible for the node to backfeed dangerous power onto the down grid.
Yes, it guarantees safe, instantaneous isolation.
And because it guarantees that safety without crossing public streets or selling power back to the grid, it completely bypasses the PUC's definition of an electrical corporation.
Exactly. You avoid the multi-year interconnection bottleneck entirely.
You secure the critical infrastructure first, legally and quietly, behind the meter. That is brilliant.
That's very pragmatic.
Which leads us to phase three, spanning months 7 through 18, scale the mesh and P2P integration.
Once you have successfully deployed multiple independent nodes behind the meters at various facilities across town, you have one at the hospital, one at the shelter, one at the pump station, they are all operating autonomously.
Right.
Now you activate the local mesh networking. The RIO's operating system utilizes dynamic routing protocols to wirelessly link the adjacent facilities together.
The sources specifically name Babel and OLSRV2 protocols. How do those actually form a mesh without laying cables between the buildings?
Think of it like a highly organized digital game of telephone. In traditional routing, every router needs a static map of the entire network. If a cable is cut, the map is broken and data stops.
Sure.
Protocols like OLSRV2 optimized link state routing are dynamic. Every node constantly shouts its location and its connection strength into the airwaves.
Like, I am the hospital node, I can see the fire station node clearly, but the school node signal is weak.
Exactly. Every node builds a dynamic, constantly updating map based on who it can hear. If a tree falls on the water pump node and it goes silent, the other nodes instantly update their maps.
So they just go around it.
Yeah. The hospital node realizes it can no longer send data directly to the pump, so it seamlessly reroutes its telemetry through the fire station node, which relays it to the school, which relays it to the backup pump.
So they form an invisible, self-healing net of data telemetry over the airways.
They share situational awareness. And as local microgrid policies begin to modernize, the white paper cites California's Senate Bill 1339 and AB 2175 as precedents for gradually exempting localized microgrids from strict utility status. The nodes can be software updated.
To do what?
Once legally permitted, they begin safely sharing bidirectional energy across short local distances, perhaps crossing a single street between the hospital and a clinic. You incrementally, legally build that K-connected spherical resilience completely on the community's own timeline, avoiding the monopoly's blockade.
So let's step back and summarize the incredible architectural journey we've just mapped out for you all.
We've covered a lot of ground.
We started by looking at the inherent mathematical fragility of our century-old linear grids, how one severed transmission line or frozen gas pipe can mathematically plunge an entire region into chaos.
That linear fragility.
But we explored how moving to a spherically resilient K-connected mesh topology bounds those physical failures.
Yeah.
We saw how edge AI, running on highly efficient commodity hardware inside a ruggedized shipping container, enables a community to survive completely off the grid in island mode, evaluating multiple disparate networks millisecond by millisecond.
It's all about that autonomy factor.
We unpacked how DPEN economics and P2P trading turn the grid into a closed-loop community garden, empowering towns to shift from crushing centralized debt to fractional, localized ownership.
A completely new financial model.
And finally, we walk through the highly strategic, entirely legal, behind-the-meter deployment playbook that outsmarts legacy monopolies, allowing regional planners to deploy this life-saving technology today.
It really represents a profound paradigm shift in civil engineering. We are witnessing the decentralization of physical survival.
That's huge.
But as comprehensive as these engineering blueprints and economic models are, there is one final, incredibly forward-looking concept hidden deep in the remaining gap section of the research that demands attention.
Oh, lay it on me.
The hardware, the software, the thermal generators, and the fractional economic models are undeniably deployable right now. We know how to build the machines. But the next great frontier isn't going to be about physics or battery chemistry or even routing protocols.
What is it going to be about?
It is going to be about machine identity.
Machine identity. Are we talking about giving AI a passport?
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
Think about the complex sovereign world we just described. You have autonomous hardware nodes independently making life or death energy triage decisions.
Right.
They are physically trading data and financial value completely offline, peer-to-peer, over local mesh networks without any human intervention or centralized cloud oversight.
So no one is watching them.
Exactly. How do we establish persistent, undeniable trust between machines when there is no centralized authority, no global bank, no master internet server to verify who is who?
Oh, I see. If the hospital node is trying to buy power from the school node, how does the school node mathematically prove it is actually talking to the hospital and not some compromised laptop spoofing the signal to steal electricity?
Exactly. We rely on the localized hardware security modules, but that requires an entirely new framework of digital trust.
Yeah.
Furthermore, what happens to our traditional legal frameworks? We entirely lack AI-native compliance structures and jurisdiction-aware policy systems.
That is a staggering thought. In a future where the physical infrastructure itself becomes fully autonomous and legally isolated from the broader state, who actually governs the machines?
That's the million-dollar question.
If an AI-driven node makes a localized economic decision, say, surging power prices during a blizzard to protect battery reserves, and that decision heavily impacts a municipality while the node is completely isolated from the global internet and state regulators, what laws apply?
Does the machine have sovereign jurisdiction over its physical bubble?
Man, it is the ultimate question of infrastructure sovereignty. We're solving the hardware layer, we're solving the software layer, but the final, most complex layer we have to build is autonomous governance.
It is a profound philosophical challenge wrapped in a metal box.
It definitely is. It is definitely something to mull over the next time a severe storm rolls in, the lights flicker, the power goes out, and as you sit there in the dark, you wonder, what if the system just decided to fix itself?